had this technology in 1947.
I know, but I will mention some technologies which were introduced then. For instance, the first microwave oven went on sale. It was apparently about as tall as a room in New York, and it cost $6,000. How impressive, how well it worked, I don't quite know. Excuse me, to move the slides on. Yes, that's right. And there we are. There. Well, thank you very much, Christopher. And thank you for coming, and thank you to LSE Ideas, which I've been associated with over the years, and which has certainly earned its high ranking among think tanks globally, and so on. So, and I'm very pleased to be speaking about this book. The genre of the year, the month, the week, or even the day that changed the world has become a familiar publishing trope, I think, recently. But obviously, I argue in this book, and I hope in the next 40 minutes I'll be able to explain why. This was really a period which forged the world to come for the following 70 years, and which in many ways today still survives, but is under challenge, as Christopher said, in certain areas. The period is often seen through the prism of the Cold War, which took its shape during these years, as I'll go on to in a minute. But in fact, the geographical reach impact of the Cold War and the relationship between the USSR and the United States was at this stage in history relatively limited. And it's one of the what-ifs if that relative hands-off attitude, which one saw both from Moscow and Washington during this period, not always voluntary, sometimes simply because they couldn't get involved, if that had persisted, how that would have changed various elements in the global scene in the following decades. For instance, the Moscow-Washington relationship was really of relatively little importance in the creation of Israel and the First Middle East War. It was virtually absent entirely from India and Pakistan's independence, the partition, and their subsequent war. And I would argue that even Mao Zedong in China, while undoubtedly fancying himself as a great communist theoretician, espoused Chinese nationalism more than fealty to Moscow, and on several occasions actually downright refused to do what Stalin told him, notably to stop the People's Liberation Army advancing in the middle of China so as to divide China, which would have given the Kremlin the divided neighbor nation that it wanted. The famous photographer Robert Capa wrote in his diary, when he heard of the end of the war in Europe, end of the war in Europe, now there is no reason to get up in the morning. Well, that may have been so for him, although, of course, he went on to photograph many conflicts thereafter. But in fact, the end of the Second World War left a world which was devastated in many parts of Europe and Asia, and in which the United States' wealth at that period stood out even more than it would in subsequent years. The three heads of the leading Allied nations met only once at Potsdam, here with Attlee, who'd taken Churchill's place, and with Truman playing quite a marginal role, in fact, and Stalin reinforcing the claim to Eastern Europe, Eastern Central Europe, the security belt that he wanted to build up, which he'd fashioned during the war through the previous summits and through the advance of the Red Army. As he said, the social system of countries would be decided by force, who had the maximum force in those countries, and he certainly made that the case in Eastern and Central Europe. The leaders never met again as a group. Indeed, Truman and Attlee didn't meet. This was completely different from today's world, when leaders hold regular summits and jet around the world. The actual physical distance was very considerable, and at times gave both great importance to diplomatic exchanges, and also left people on the ground with more latitude to act for themselves than, of course, exists with today's communications. While the leaders did not meet, the foreign ministers continued a series of increasingly desultory conferences in New York, in Paris, in Moscow, and in London. Bidault, the French foreign minister, was always fighting to affirm a place at the top table for his country. He and the French were still deeply afraid of a revival of German power. And Bidault was had considerable difficulty for much of the time in asserting this French position, not helped by his very unhealthy lifestyle. He was said to breakfast on gherkins, lunch on onions, and drink far too much wine in between, known as in Bidault Veritas by some people. Molotov carried on from the war years as the Soviet foreign minister, and for this period at any rate, as Stalin's trusted lieutenant, known colloquially among his colleagues as Iron Arse for his ability to sit through endless meetings. George Marshall, who we'll come to in a minute, had become Secretary of State at the beginning of 1947 after acting as the US Chief of Staff during the Second World War, said by Churchill to be the man who really won the war. He'd then been sent by Truman on a hopeless mission to China to try to bring Mao and Chiang Kai-shek together before becoming Secretary of State. And Ernest Bevin dominate taking up most of the space on the side of the picture there. The former trade union leader who had rather unexpectedly become foreign secretary and who is a fascinating figure who I go into quite a lot in the book, with a definite imperial nostalgia and an unwillingness to accept, although he had to deal with the consequences of, the decline of Britain as a global power. He, like Bidault, was not in good health. His doctor at one point examined him and said the only healthy thing about him was his right left big toe. He lumbered about, drank far too much, ate far too much, but became a bulwark of the Western camp in these early years of the Second World War. Truman was in great awe of George Marshall, whom he regarded quite rightly as a major political trump for him, a major political card for him, at a time when his chances of election in 1948 were put very low indeed. Truman had come to the presidency again unexpectedly, although having written a book about the Second World War leaders, I'm amazed that anybody could not have expected Franklin Roosevelt to keel over and die, given his terrible state of health. This bad health is something that runs through a lot of the leaders of this time. Truman had not been taken to any of the wartime conferences. He hadn't been included in foreign affairs, which Roosevelt tended to run out of his office at the White House, rather than through the, certainly not through the vice presidency. He hadn't been told, for instance, about the atom bomb project before he became president. And he was, in the early period of his presidency, he was deeply conflicted about whether he should stand up to Stalin. He had a notably stormy meeting with Molotov only 10 days after moving into the White House, or whether he'd gone too far and the Roosevelt-ian idea of perpetuating the wartime alliance could be given new life after the defeat of Hitler and the Italians. Truman was open to guidance all through this. He depended a lot on Marshall, but also on what were known as the wise men, Dean Acheson, Kennan, and the others, who really fashioned the US policy, which was a vital departure at this period in bringing America into world affairs in a way that it hadn't been after the end of the First World War, of course, with the retreat into isolationism. Instead, Truman catapulted his country into this global role, helped hugely by bipartisan support in Washington, with the Republicans, while they were deeply critical of him on domestic affairs and economic policy, cooperating with the administration in fashioning this world role. And that, of course, was backed up by the extent of American economic preponderance, its military position. It was the only power with the atom bomb at this stage. Mind you, when Truman did enunciate what became known as the Truman Doctrine in April 1947, which was on paper to defend democracies against oppression and aggression, wherever it came from, the Americans chose probably two of the worst cases for help that you could in the world. Greece, which was run by a largely corrupt small group of politicians, and Turkey, which was run by a deaf and ailing military autocrat. Hardly a propitious beginning for this crusade for democracy, and of course echoed over the years by similar support to, as Lyndon Johnson put it, our bastards. Marshall, the plan which Marshall gave his name to was conceived really by the State Department officials who had been to Europe and were deeply afraid that Stalin would not extend Soviet power through by military means, but would do so on the back of economic and social collapse in countries like France and Italy. And the need for the United States and the self-interest for the United States in buttressing those countries led to Marshall's speech in June 1947 at Harvard, which set the groundwork for the plan. It was not the most ungenerous undertaking ever known to human history, as Churchill said. I may paraphrase him slightly wrongly. And America certainly saw its economic interest in building up the West European economies, as well as the military interest in strengthening them. But it was an act which was important, above all, in committing the US to this global role, at least in the North Atlantic area, backed by the decision to keep on troops in Western Europe after the war. Roosevelt had suggested to Stalin that they might come home. This is Truman signing the act, with Dean Acheson looking on there. When Truman said to Marshall, the plan will be called after you, Marshall said, you can't possibly do that. This is the Truman plan. And Truman, looking at the Republican majority in Congress, said, you think if it has my name on it, it has any chance of getting through Congress? So, as always, Truman is very interesting. He's playing politics while doing what he sees as the big right thing. On the other side of what became known as the Iron Curtain, we had, of course, Stalin, the dyed-in-the-wool dictator, with experience through the savage aftermath of the 1917 revolution, his own rise to the top. And he was intent Stalin all the time on maintaining not just his own personal position and security, but the security of the Soviet Union, with this broad belt of countries that would follow Moscow running through Eastern and Central Europe. He's here with Mao Zedong on Mao's first visit to Moscow, Walter Ulbricht, who ran East Germany, and of course Khrushchev on his right. In September 47, in response in part to the Marshall Plan, although the idea had been about earlier, Stalin charged Zhdanov here with the job of corralling and disciplining the communist parties of Europe. Again, this is a European story. It didn't involve Asian parties, although some of them were pretty big. And this led to the foundation of the Cominform, which was basically the means for Moscow to ensure that its writ ran all the way to the division line in the center of the continent. While the Cold War developed in this way, there was also an often rather forgotten hot war in Europe. In Greece, here we have a Greek communist general on the left, which led Truman to pour in aid and develop the Truman Doctrine. The rebels were always quite confined to the north of Greece. Stalin disapproved of them because it went against his percentages agreement during the war with Churchill to divide up Eastern Europe. He disapproved of the way that Albania and Yugoslavia helped the rebels. They were there. They couldn't really mount major military offensives and were gradually ground down by the weight of American support for the government in Athens. There was a degree of independence in Eastern Europe at this stage, notably in Czechoslovakia, which remained at least a quasi-democracy. The Communist Party had come out as the main, the winner, the main vote-getter in parliamentary elections, but was still short of a majority. And other parties could, in theory, have blocked the communist rise. But the communists under Gottwald in Czechoslovakia were extremely well organized, very strongly backed by Moscow in this case, staging mass demonstrations, strikes, and taking advantage of a terrible mistake by their political opponents in failing to form a coalition and resigning from the government to carry out a putsch or semi-putsch in the early part of 1948. Jan Masaryk, perhaps the best known Czechoslovak internationally, who was foreign minister, stayed on. He had been to Moscow the previous year when Stalin had ordered Czechoslovakia not to accept Marshall Plan aid, and famously said that he went to Moscow as the foreign minister of a free country and came back as a slave of the Kremlin. He then died a mysterious death. I'm fairly convinced, and I set out the evidence in the book, that it was murder, thrown or jumping from the fourth floor window of his official bedroom. And after that, Czechoslovakia really became part of the East European, Central European security bloc on which Stalin put such store. Meanwhile, in Western Europe, one is sometimes forgotten how communist parties were also extremely strong. In Italy, Togliatti here, they were certainly the second party and challenged the Christian Democrats in general elections in April 1948, which the Christian Democrats won under De Gasperi, using American help the power of the Catholic Church and mobilizing conservative opinion, using religion with the phrase, Stalin cannot see you in the ballot box, God can. So make sure you vote the right way. That the CIA was quite active in this election, and that set Italy really on the subsequent path of having a strong communist party, particularly strong in some municipalities such as Bologna, but with the Christian Democrats ruling with varying degrees of efficiency over the decades to come. In France, Maurice Thorez, former miner, headed the Communist Party, which came out top again in several elections after the war, and could mobilize not just huge demonstrations, but also the trade unions through the CGT Federation, which carried out a series of major strikes and demonstrations, train derailments at the end of 47, that brought it into fairly open warfare with the Socialist Christian Democrats governments of the time. And eventually the governments won out and the communists retreated into, as in Italy, more or less perpetual opposition. In France, there was also the wartime figure of Charles de Gaulle, who launched his rally for the French people, attacking the government and the Fourth Republic, which had taken over after the war, attacking them from the right. De Gaulle did very well, or his party did very well, in municipal elections, becoming the largest electoral grouping in France at municipal level, but was never able to translate it into national terms, partly because the general would have nothing to do with the Fourth Republic, and his intransigence pushed him into, not opposition, but into the wilderness at Colombe les Deux Églises before he came back, of course, in 1958. For the Americans, the Social Democrats in Europe, although they might profess socialism, were in general welcome allies, much better than the right, which had been besmirched, devalued by the 1930s and the wartime experience. And the birth of Christian Democrat parties, or the revival of Christian centrist parties, was an extremely important element in the construction of Western Europe during this period and on into the further flowering of the Cold War. Here we have Konrad Adenauer and Kurt Schumacher in Germany. Adenauer, of course, who always won out against his more ideological opponent. In France, Robert Schuman, who was said of him that when he made a speech, people didn't get angry, they just went to sleep. And, of course, Attlee in Britain with the particular British road to Jerusalem under the Labour government. Welfare extension was broadly accepted, certainly in Europe and increasingly in North America too at this period, with nationalisations, the National Health Service, and the idea that the state, the government, now had a responsibility for the well-being of citizens in a way that it hadn't before the war. The world was changing socially, particularly, as I say, in Europe. In the United States, the GI Bill gave education to millions of returning servicemen, and in many countries which hadn't done it before, women got the vote, including in France and on the left in Japan, where a number of female candidates won election to the Diet. This was also a period of technological, I said I'd come back to the technology, advance at the time, in many ways which carried on from the wartime R&D effort in aviation and travel. The first LP records were put on sale, the first transistor was patented, and as I say, the first microwave oven was produced in New York at a very high cost, and it is not recorded how many people bought it. The period was marked by anti-colonialism, which I would argue really took its lasting shape during the time after 1947 for a combination of reasons, including in Asia the way that the European powers had been humiliated by the Japanese in 1941, and in other parts of the world by the increasing difficulty of the European colonial powers in holding on to their empires. On the left, a picture from Madagascar, where there's a largely forgotten revolt against French rule, which lasted for a very long time and involved scorched earth tactics by the French forces, throwing people out of aeroplanes, torching villages, devastating the countryside and crops, before eventually that revolt was brought to an end, with the French throughout, including the socialists in power in Paris, saying that they were merely carrying out a civilizational mission. Britain faced riots in what had been the model colony for London up to then, the Gold Coast, now Ghana, of course, which shook the progress there towards independence, which I go into in the book, and is notable for the way in which the British reacted with a mixture of force, as we see here, but also an understanding from a number of senior civil servants in Whitehall that the move towards independence was inevitable. In Asia, the Viet Minh, who had resisted the Japanese and received American help, here we see Ho Chi Minh and Giap with some American advisors. The Viet Minh tried to combat the French, was beaten back in a series of frontal battles, engagements, although the French never managed to capture Ho. I describe in the book one particular parachute expedition which arrived in the Viet Minh headquarters caught them by surprise so much that the food was still cooking on the cooking stoves when the French paratroopers moved in. But the Viet Minh went back into the countryside and began the classic guerrilla campaign, which of course continued for a long time to come. In Indonesia, Sukarno, who had become the nationalist Republican leader there, allied himself with the Japanese during the war, regarding them as better than the Dutch colonialists, and after the war dealt with an extremely messy situation. The Dutch were still there. They launched two military offensives, which I describe in the book, beat back the Republicans, but the Dutch in the end did not have the force to subjugate the whole of Indonesia. They also had the problem that the United States was keen on Indonesia gaining independence, and not too veiled threats were made that if the Dutch resisted this, they might not get martial aid, which they needed so badly. One move in the other direction, in South Africa, the national government won power unexpectedly in elections in June 1948 and introduced apartheid, the beginning of that era. For Britain, the colonial burden, as they would have put it at the time, had simply become too great, and withdrawal was, I think, clearly inevitable for Attlee and his ministers. This included Palestine, here a meeting in London, with Bevin looking quite disconsolate, as he often was, over the subject of Palestine. Britain handed the issue over to the United Nations, which voted for the partition of Palestine, opening the way to the creation of the State of Israel. The Arab camp was badly divided in opposing this, whereas the Zionists were completely united, despite their personal quarrels and struggles. And in particular, the king of Transjordan, Abdullah, wanted for Palestine to gain independence from the British mandate, to come under his control, promising the Zionists that he would create a Jewish state within this larger country, which he would rule in conjunction with Jordan. But that was deeply opposed by other Arab leaders, including the Saudi Arabians there, with the result that there was always disarray within the Arab ranks during this period of jockeying before partition and the creation of the State of Israel. The situation was, of course, exacerbated by the refugee issue. The Jewish refugees from Europe, whom Britain was turning back whenever it could, sending them to camps in Cyprus, or even in the case of the Exodus here, to Germany, and the expulsion and flight of the Palestinians, both before war broke out and then afterwards, which was matched by the expulsion or flight of Jewish residents in Arab countries. And this was part of an enormous population movement which was going on at this period, all the way from Central Europe, where Germans were being expelled en masse from countries like Czechoslovakia, all the way through to Korea, from which the Japanese were being expelled. There was an enormous movement of forced, for the most part, of people during this period, and I'll come to India and Pakistan in a minute. The war that broke out was thought by many people to be a walkover for the Arab armies, given their numbers and their equipment, but turned out to be very much the reverse, as the new Jewish state got weapons, largely from Czechoslovakia, as it happens, and fought back to defend the territory which had been given to it by the UN partition, and then expanded into territory which had been allocated to the Arab countries, starting, of course, the long process of conflict which goes on to this day. India was much bigger, and here the British were in a rather unseemly rush to get out, it must be said. Particularly Mountbatten, the last viceroy, flanked here by Nehru and Jinnah. Mountbatten, who distributed to his staff enormous calendars with each day to partition being marked out, and they would turn them over and had to make sure they did their necessary piece of work that day. Mountbatten, I think, thought he was earning himself a great place in history through this, but the result of the incredibly hurried and botched division between India and Pakistan, entrusted to an English lawyer who was given 6 weeks to do the job, was always a recipe for disaster. Although, of course, it was celebrated by the British, with newspapers here saying how Britain had left India in a much better state than it found it, with all the ceremonial there in Delhi and in Pakistan, but before partition already, the movement of millions of people between the two new countries, with vastly overcrowded trains, processions of refugees stretching for scores of miles, and horrendous violence between Muslims, Hindus and Sikhs during this period, which reduced Nehru to desperation at times and appears to have influenced the seemingly imperturbable Jinnah, that at what he had unleashed through this hurried and botched and very mutually aggressive policies during this period. See here, this is in a frontier town, the kind of damage that was done. And within months of the independence of the two countries, in August 2017, India and Pakistan were at war in Kashmir, which both claimed, and where the ruler said he would unite with India, but tribesmen allied with Pakistan came in, and that war began and again continues to this day. In China, moving further east, as I said, Marshall had been on what was a mission impossible to try to bring together Chiang Kai-shek and Mao Zedong. This is one of the few cases where a woman was playing a prominent role in the politics that I've been talking about, Madam Chiang Kai-shek. Otherwise, I'm afraid it was very much a male-dominated period. After the defeat of Japan, Chiang had received support, military aid, from the United States, but he squandered the advantage that he had there. Marshall forced him into a ceasefire, which, according to Chiang, was the vital thing in allowing the communists to escape from the nationalist offensives. And by 1947, the communist areas were expanding very considerably, both in the northeast, Manchuria, with which Chiang had a complete fixation. He sent all his best troops in there and lost most of them. He lost so much equipment that it kitted out the PLA in quite a substantial manner. They were also moving in the centre of China, the Central Plains, with an offensive in which Deng Xiaoping was a political commissar and had pockets of support elsewhere. The fighting was often very brutal indeed. But there was no doubt that the PLA was a far better organized and, in the end, better equipped, partly through the arms it had captured from the nationalists, partly through Russian supplies, better equipped force with a definite strategic plan from Mao and his lieutenants, which was put into effect in 47-48. But also, the communist victory, which may have been mainly a military achievement in many ways, was accompanied and facilitated by the economic and social dislocation of China. The war with occupation by Japan, which went back to 1931 in the northeast and lasted from 1937 with the full-scale Sino-Japanese War, that had torn apart the social fabric, the institutions of China. The nationalist government was pretty ineffective, was pretty corrupt, but it also made things worse by undermining what remained of those institutions. The economy was in a complete mess, with inflation running at thousands percent per week. This is famous Cartier-Bresson picture of people trying to get into a bank in Shanghai. And the arrival of the communists in the central Yangtze area, where the capital Nanjing was, and then Shanghai, meant really the end of the nationalist government, although it managed to hold on for a time. What is interesting, looking back at that period, and again I quote a lot from State Department records in this, is that many people in Washington, including Marshall and the State Department, and one suspects Truman, were actually quite happy to see the communists win in China. They would have preferred to have had a more resilient ally than the nationalists and Chiang. But Kennan, George Kennan, the main State Department planner, wrote off China as being really of no importance. It's never going to be an industrial power. Don't worry about it. If we lose it, too bad. And Truman, of course, classically hated the nationalists, mainly for supporting the China lobby against him among the Republicans, and condemned Chiang and his, quote, gang as corrupt, every one of them. They all should be in jail. So those were not the best of allies. On the other hand, the United States made Japan into the central key to its approach, its strategic approach to East Asia, with MacArthur, of course, as the domineering consul general there, set initially on a path of democratization, decapitalization, demilitarization, but partly under Kennan's influence and with American business lobbies also working hard on it, this was quite swiftly changed during the course of 48, as I describe in the book, into the objective of building up Japan as an industrial power again. While back in Europe, while Stalin seemed with the putsch in Czechoslovakia to have solidified his position in East Central continent, he faced in 48 the challenge from Tito. In a sense, Tito and Stalin were never going to get on because they were both too ambitious for their own purposes. And Tito, who headed, of course, one of the few armies, the only army in Eastern Europe, which had won the war fought against the Germans on its own, and he'd been brought to power by the Yugoslav National Army rather than on the coattails of the Red Army, was bound, I think, to break with Stalin at some point. And just as Stalin, after the uniformity of the Cominform, was intent on stamping his own brand on the whole of East Central Europe. So we had the split in 48, which produced another pole, if you like, of communist attractiveness for those in the West who had grown somewhat disenchanted by the behaviour of Stalin in the Kremlin. While Japan was being rebuilt by the Americans, the same was so for Germany, which of course had been in a completely devastated position. Here's Berlin at the end of the war. The division of Germany became embedded during this period of 47-48. Stalin tried what was his most audacious, if you like, move in the summer of 48 with the blockade of Berlin, attempting really to establish that the Soviet Union would determine the future of Germany and its wartime capital, its pre-war capital, but met by the airlift led by the Americans, the British and others. And from that came the real, establishment of the Cold War, with retreat on either side ruled out, but I think very little actual danger of a major military confrontation on the ground in Europe, as many had feared. So this period, from the summer of 47 to the summer of 48, represents a time of huge change across the world, out of which a new global order was growing in many ways, both with the American involvement, the Cold War, of course, the American involvement in the Cold War wittingly or unwittingly, well, wittingly, gave rise to European unification, and we may say led on to the EU, although, of course, Trump now says that the EU was set up to exploit the United States. If you read the American documentation of the time, it's very much the opposite, that the United States wanted an economically united Western Europe as a bulwark against the Soviet Union. We had India and Pakistan, we had the communists winning in China, we had the division of Korea, which I haven't mentioned, apartheid in South Africa, which lasted for a long time, the creation of Israel, and the confrontation and conflict in the Middle East. That is why I think this must be seen as a period that forged the world we live in today, and I hope you agree. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. We're going to take some questions. I will start with one myself, the usual prerogatives of the chair. And but can everybody who wants to ask a question put their hands up in a moment and identify yourself and your institutional affiliation if you have one. Just to start the ball rolling, you mentioned some of these famous historical figures. How much did they actually shape events? How much did historical forces shape events? Because that's always the question that we always ask in this respect. And if the individuals did, who were the villains and who were the real heroes of this, out of your cast of characters?
Well, the second part of the question involves value judgment, which I'm not sure, well, I can come to in a minute. I realise it's very unfashionable to write about people as shaping history these days. It's either historical events or it's the price of bread or whatever else that may be. But I think in this period, individuals were extremely important. And I devote a part of the first chapter of the book to outlining why that should be so. I think Stalin's personality shaped Soviet policy to quite extraordinary degree. I think also that Truman, while having started, as I say, not knowing where he was, as he said the day after he was sworn in as president, it was like being hit by a bale of hay on the head and seeing stars, not knowing where he was. He developed a determined personage, which was, I think, important in backing up Marshall and the wise men, if you like. And on a specific example to take there where people are important, the decision of the United States to recognize Israel, that was very much Truman running against the State Department. I mean, Marshall more or less threatened to resign and said that if Truman did recognize Israel against the State Department, he wouldn't vote for Truman in the 48 election. So the president was actually for reasons which, as always with Truman, you can say he's following a certain policy line, high policy if you like, but also there are political calculations behind it. As he once said to a group of Arab ambassadors who visited him, yes, I hear everything you say about Palestine, but I just remind you that I have X million Jewish voters, and as far as I know, no Arab voters there. And it was the same on race relations. You know, he pushed through desegregation measures, but he got a report in his back pocket saying he couldn't be re-elected in 48 unless he had the black vote. So you don't know. So I think they were important, those people. I think Bevin did play an important role in the connection with the United States that was quite a personal one, although often difficult, on the question of Palestine. I think Chiang Kai-shek's, going back to an old theme, inability to delegate, his military incompetence, and the way he put loyalty above ability among the commanders and other people around him, did have a lot to do with the outcome in China, just as Mao's completely relentless determination did too. Now, are those good or bad? Does that make Mao a good person? No. It doesn't make... I mean, you know, his legacy was terrible in the end.
Stalin, I think, you know, was a retrograde figure in this period. So I would put him in the bad camp. Truman I would put in the good camp. Now, I know that's taking a very bipartisan Cold War view, which many people may disagree with.
Thank you very much. Right, let's open it up. So, who'd like to?
Yes. Ed Coltman, MSc in Economic History at LSE. I'm going to go to a silly question, but I don't think I'll ever get a chance to ask it. After my reading of World War II and particularly Stalin, it seems like a lot of historians now believe that the way to Stalin heart would be drinking, essentially. Do you believe that the replacement of Churchill and leaders who are less partial to a couple after dinner?
I don't know.
Impacted this at all, or do you think?
I don't think it impacted it at all. Stalin and drinking is, I wrote a bit about it in the book. I mean, it's a brief thing, but I could have gone on and on and on because the literature is enormous. But quite a few sources, which you may know this better than I, say that by this period, he was actually drinking relatively little. And a lot of it was white wine, perhaps watered down. And what he liked to do was to get his subordinates and lieutenants drunk, where they make a fool of themselves, and so on and so on, rather than imbibing hugely himself. As for the other, as I say, Bido was quite a drinker. There were various other people. The Czechoslovak communist leader was so incapable of drink that he had to be supported sometimes when speaking. So there were drinkers around. I would say during this period, perhaps more important than alcohol was the bad health of quite a few of the leaders. I referred to some of them. I mean, Stalin was in pretty bad health by this period. Jinnah was dying in Pakistan. And there were lots of other cases of people who were, they shouldn't have been there, as the French say, these sick people who rule us.
Yes.
Sorry. He was quite bashful, Eisenhower, at this period. There was a big draft Eisenhower movement in 47-48 there, which he rejected the whole time. And even Truman is said to have said to someone that if Eisenhower ran, Truman wouldn't. He would hand over to Eisenhower. But Eisenhower, if you see Eisenhower as a long-term player, I think he was waiting his time more than anything else. He didn't have that much influence. The Republicans were fighting among themselves enough at that time between Dewey, Taft, and the others.
How far would you say the fact that Stalin captured?
I think he actually believed in that, and Stalin did, by and large, keep to the agreements he'd made. He thought he had an agreement from the Tehran and Yalta conferences during the war that the Soviet Union would have this big security belt where it could do as it wished, more or less, and that all the talk by Roosevelt and Churchill during the war of democracies, supporting democracies in Poland and other countries, was for the birds, really, and so on. So I think Stalin, he did keep to his word in those terms, but it depends on what terms, you had to interpret them in his terms. Interestingly, at Potsdam, Truman came back quite liking Stalin, saying he's a man of his word. He's an SOB, but he's a man of his word. So,
this question, yes, I'm back.
I'm Peter, I'm asking with your ideas. I'm asking for one question. Was there any sense among the major leaders at the time that they were taking on too much, that we had just kind of entered into a post-war period, the Marshall Plan was a humongous endeavor? Were any of the leaders secretly or behind the scenes taking leadership?
kind of tap the brakes on solving all the problems throughout the entire world during this short period of time?
I don't think among the US or Soviet leaders to any serious degree. You have Truman in his letters to his wife, which are, you know, where he blows off steam, as it were, several times. He said, this is all just too much. I mean, he goes into apocalyptic visions of the Red Army coming up through Yugoslavia and Italy, invading France, and so on and so on, etc., etc. So he's, you know, he's kind of aware at those times of where this could all lead. But you don't really have that among them. You do have it, where you do have it is in the former Raj, in India and Pakistan, where certainly Nehru said, you know, we made, paraphrasing roughly, we made a mess of it because we were just too tired and trying to do too much. And that certainly is the impression that Jinnah gave to those around him, that, you know, this is all spiraled out of control, which it did, of course, and it was the, you know, the failure of the of any institutions that were there to be able to control the communal violence and population movements that made it such a tragedy, such a disaster. But I think those were the that's the only example I can think of where what you say would be the case.
Can I pick you up on that theme of control or lack of control? Because, so when Christopher was introducing the book, he said, But actually, what for me came out of your talk most strongly was in the sense of the lack of control. Yes, enduring structures, enduring conflicts, enduring trends were put in place, but they were done so not because they were seen or designed or drawn up, but because a series of accidents and misunderstandings existed. So the world that was created was probably the one that had designed us.
I think it was, I'd agree with you to a certain extent. I think this was a much more, if you like, fragmented or multi-dimensional world there. And at this point, what's interesting, that's what I said right at the beginning, is how the two major Cold War powers did not try to assert themselves, for instance, in India and Pakistan or in the Middle East, except for the oil interests to some extent, or I would say in China. In the end. So they were willing to, they were, as were having their conflict there without seeking to put other parts of the world into the straitjacket they were creating for themselves with the Cold War. So, yes, I agree.
And let us.
Yeah.
Maybe just a
bit of
a follow on from that question. I mean, the picture I got was of a kind of realist world where power politics was dominant, and I guess everybody after the war was coming to terms with the reality the British Empire was having to decolonize and so on and so forth. But also, this is a time of idealism when international institutions were being built and Human Rights Declaration, I think, was. Signed at that time, and so on and so forth. So how much of this kind of idealism did you find in your research?
Perhaps in speeches on the page, but relatively little in actual action, I would say. Yeah. I think idealism, I should have mentioned international organisations, of course, you know, all the way from the UN to the IMF to the GATT to everything else, so on. There was some hope, probably, during the war that kind of international partnerships could be carried on beyond the defeat of Germany and Japan. But I think by 45 it had pretty much dissipated. In the reality of politics there. And if you read, I mean, Stalin, I've talked about, you know, is certainly a brutal realist on his side, but if you read the American particularly the State Department papers there, they are very cut and dry realistic too there. I mean, Kennan's, which I quote Kennan from the book, Kennan's note, which formed the basis, in fact, of the Marshall Plan, was we need to rebuild Western Europe, A, to prevent it falling into collapsing and falling into Soviet hands, B, to provide export markets. There, no idealistic seed, but I can see.
Just picking up on that economic point you referred to, Jack, IMF, and these things, how far have things got by 47-48? How far have thinking that we now associate with the post-war order got?
It had got quite a long way in Washington, I think. Particularly, you know, on the basis of the IMF and the World Bank, and with the negotiations for GATT before the WTO, which were very, very hard-nosed indeed, with the British playing a particularly hard-nosed area there. But I think in most of the rest of the world, the devastation of the war, which, again, we may forget about, that was there, and which lasted through until into 47-48. It wasn't as if the end of the war and everything, you know, suddenly perked up again. In fact, the UN, you know, noted that the world economy had gone backwards in 46-47 and so on. And the whole reconstruction effort and the dependence on the United States and the primacy of the dollar at that point inhibited grander planning there. And a lot of countries, I mean, with the Marshall Plan, you see that Britain, up to quite a late stage, was trying to cut a separate deal of its own with the United States, apart from the Marshall Plan. There was a lot of jockeying still for national advantage in, if you like, what would then be seen as an old-fashioned way.
I mean, one of the interesting things that Arnie Westep says in his book on the Cold War is that Soviet support for China was much more extensive than the Marshall Plan. Western Europe and lasted twice as long before the break. But people like Alan Millwood would argue that I think the Marshall Plan is exaggerated. The German economy was bouncing back very fast, 46-47. Yes. And that even without it, there would have been a European recovery, perhaps slightly later, but nevertheless inevitable.
I think the Marshall Plan was essential. There would have been a recovery, but it gave the way it put petrol in the tank and so on and that. And equally important, something I just mentioned in passing, was the way Truman reversed Roosevelt's intention of bringing troops back, and the troops remained, US troops remained in Western Europe, which, as it were, gave governments dedicated to the Atlantic Alliance a lot more confidence. But I think the Marshall Plan was, it varied from place to place. It depended on how countries used it, and some of the effects were not seen for a long time to come. Mm-hmm. But I would still put it as pretty important.
You didn't mention Latin America.
I know, and a reviewer in Brazil, somebody forwarded it to me, said no, only one mention of Latin America. I did mention Brazil briefly. But Latin America was, it wasn't central at this point, the kind of things I was talking about. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I was really struck earlier in the talk by what you said about opportunity of leaders and how regularly you were having diplomacy. Because in my mind, it doesn't seem intuitive to be the case
Well, I wouldn't say they didn't meet often. They didn't meet at all. That was really my point there, that Truman, I think, only went outside the United States once during his first term, which was to South America briefly. There was very little of that, meeting face-to-face at the top. Of course, they might not have got anywhere. That is absolutely true, I think. And I think probably evident of support for that was the way the conferences of foreign ministers declined steadily, and you had this rather terrible meeting in London in November 47, where really, you know, nobody had anything to say to each other, and when in the end Marshall said, well, let's adjourn, and somebody said, when shall we meet again? And there was blank silence, and they never did.
Well, I think if Churchill had won the 45 election, he would have hopped on planes.
He probably would have been much more, yes. But Attlee wasn't somebody to hop on planes, and Bevin was going to deal at foreign minister level very largely. And I mean, for instance, you know, if you take China, which would be coming back to, Mao didn't go outside China until his visit to Moscow in 1949. And Chiang, apart from the Cairo conference, which was a bit of a farce in 1942, and a brief visit to India where he met Gandhi and watched Nehru standing on his head and so on, didn't you know, do the international circuit.
Madam Chiang did, didn't
he? Madam Chiang, oh, she made up for it, certainly.
And I thought one of the other women important in this area was probably Lady Mountbatten.
Do we believe the stories?
There is no special relationship.
There is no evidence for her special relationship with Nehru, but she certainly got on with him. They got on with him extremely well. There's no doubt that the Mountbattens found Nehru the proper kind of Indian gentleman they liked, they approved of and liked, whereas Jinnah, who was so overbearing and difficult to deal with.
And a big drinker.
And yeah, despite, of course, throwing in with Islam, big, never went to the mosque, big drinker, etc., etc., dying of tuberculosis.
Well, can I just bring this forward to the present day? Because I have a number of people in this audience, I think, who are probably thinking, what are the parallels that can be drawn from your study of that period in terms of personalities, for example? Your next book is going to be a comparative study of Trump and Xi Jinping. So these are two figures who are probably making our world,
as we speak.
But what other historical parallels do you actually see between the period that you've just covered and the world today?
Well, I think the big difference I would see was, you may say America was in such a dominant position that it could afford to do this, but a readiness to involve itself in multinational engagements and organisations through the Marshall Plan and through others, which increasingly we're seeing less and less of today. And also I think, I mean, the question of meetings and communications means that in that period, crises could almost evolve on their own momentum, whereas today it's very difficult without getting, you know, the great powers, the superpowers involved. And also, the difference with today is, I suppose, I've referred to this number of times, the sheer economic weight of the United States and the preponderance of the dollar and the importance of the dollar, which is still strong in the international reserve currency, but the relative decline in US economic global weight makes, I think, a huge difference.
Any other questions?
Granddaughter.
Yes, you thought the next generation.
The next generation.
The next two generations, in fact. Not just the next generation. Yeah. They'll be witnessing this changing world.
Well, indeed.
Well, I'm going to bring this meeting to an end. Can I just make just a couple of announcements before I do so? You should have been given an evaluation form because we evaluate these meetings and events and ideas. So I'd be very grateful if you could fill it in and then just leave it on the desk outside. The books are for sale, so please feel free to get them, and Jonathan will be very happy to sign them. We have an event coming up on the 18th of this month, which is looking at the global financial crisis 10 years ago, a retrospective, which Nick Stern will be chairing, and which the director of this institution will be speaking at. But I want to really just end by thanking you very much for coming here and sharing those ideas.
Thank you.